From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, the state of the air, Wisconsin's air. It turns out that warm weather played a big role in our air quality for the last few years.
Of course, we can't control the weather, which is why it's so important to control the other pollutants that go into making up ozone, the nitrogen oxides and the VOCs.
Later, a new documentary brings viewers the story of Jessie Blodgett, who was murdered even as she fought to end violence against women.
Jessie lost a lot of things when she was murdered, and so did everybody else who knew her. And that might have been the biggest one, was just her voice. To have a friend bring it back, I just jumped at the chance.
And after 10 years, the Harley-Davidson Museum makes over its signature engine room exhibit to better show off why Harley engines look, sound, and feel the way they do.
Lake Effect comes your way next, but first, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. The American Lung Association recently issued its annual State of the Air report. Parts of Wisconsin fared very well, others not so much. For nearly two decades, the group has taken air quality data from the EPA and Departments of Natural Resources from each state. Individual cities and counties are graded based on the latest EPA standards.
Lake Effect Susan Bentz went looking for some fresh air as she met Donna Wininski on a bridge in the Menominee Valley's Three Bridges Park. Wininski is the director of tobacco control and public policy for the American Lung Association's Wisconsin chapter.
We're standing in a spot that, you know, historically would have been industrial, and this has been a major cleanup. So just as an example, does this kind of an initiative make a big difference in local air quality? Does that factor in?
Oh, absolutely it does. When you look at some of the specific efforts, like We Energy's converting from being coal-fired to natural gas, that reduces emissions a lot. We're right here next to a freeway or very close to the freeway, and all of the things that have occurred over the past couple of decades to reduce not just car, but car and truck and even train emissions, those have contributed to cleaner air over the course of time, too.
Mm-hmm. So what are the trends this year that you're seeing? I read that ozone pollution worsened significantly, 2014 to 2016.
Yeah, I wouldn't say significantly. It worsened, but it was really more a factor of weather more than anything else. This report looks at data from a three-year rolling average, and this year's report that included 2014, 2015, and 2016. And I don't know if you remember, but 2016 was a somewhat unusually warm summer. And when you have higher than average temperatures, you tend to see more ozone action days. If it hadn't been as warm, we probably wouldn't have seen so much ozone forming during that period. So it really is more of a weather factor than anything else. And of course, we can't control the weather, which is why it's so important to control the other pollutants that go into making up ozone, the nitrogen oxides and the VOCs.
And where do we make that attack? How do we reduce that?
The primary sources are the coal-fired power plants, and we're doing really well in that. As I said just a couple minutes ago, we've had the We Energy's plant in the valley here convert to natural gas, which is much cleaner. Cleaner fuels have had a big impact on VOCs. More improved catalytic converters, some of the federal laws governing car mileage and what kind of miles per gallon that vehicles need to get, all of those have contributed to bringing down both the VOC emissions and the nitrogen oxide emissions, which are components of ozone.
So in the report, you're looking primarily at ozone and at small particulates?
We look at ozone and PM2.5, which is really the ultrafine particulates. And the reason that those are so important is because they are so small that they can get past the lungs' natural defense mechanisms. They get into the lungs, they embed themselves deeply into the lung tissue, they can even get into your circulatory system and then travel around your body to other organs. That's why PM2.5 is not just a lung disease risk, it's also a heart attack risk.
So when you're looking at these issues, is it primarily people who are predisposed to, you know, who have other health conditions, the elderly, the young? Are these the groups that are generally most highly impacted by these issues?
We certainly have higher risk groups, and you named most of them. It's young children because their lungs are not fully developed until about early adolescence. It's the elderly because their lungs naturally deteriorate with age, even healthy older adults. Anyone with a pre-existing lung disease, anyone with any kind of a cardiovascular disease, those are what we consider to be our high-risk groups. But then you also have to look at people who exercise outdoors, who go jogging for an hour or so every day, people who work outdoors, the road crews, the construction crews. Anybody who is spending a good part of their day outdoors is susceptible to the impact of air pollution.
That's profoundly
disturbing. It's a lot of people, unfortunately.
Yeah,
it's not just kids with asthma.
Yeah. So you talked about the difference that a corridor like this can make, I'm sure does make, because mm-hmm. there have been so many remediations. But then when we move east to Lake Michigan, the lake has its own challenges,
The lake has its own challenge. Ozone is a heavier gas. It's heavier than oxygen, so it always seeks out the lowest place, and along the lake is the lowest place geographically. And so it kind of collects along the lake. It may not even have been created right here in southeastern Wisconsin. It may have been created in Chicago or Gary, Indiana, or even St. Louis, Missouri, something like that. But if you have a good south wind, it's going to be blowing up our lakefront right along the shore and impacting all of those communities from Kenosha County all the way up to Door County. No industry whatsoever in Door County.
Right.
But yet they have bad ozone days up there.
So how does obviously you disseminate the information and it's as comprehensive as is possible based on the data you're provided. But, you know, one of the arguments one hears is, certainly we all know Racine County right now, it is a hot spot because of, by that I mean Foxconn is coming in and there are some concerns about the pollutants that could add to the environment. So the arguments I've heard as well, you know, Racine County in itself is not contributing. It's not their problem. It's, you know, they're swept into the Lake Michigan flow. How do you respond to that?
Yes and no. Yes and no. There is a factor where a sizable amount of that ozone pollution is coming from outside of Wisconsin's borders. But unless we here in southeastern Wisconsin, including Racine County, Kenosha County, Milwaukee County, unless we suddenly stopped all traffic, all industry, all power generation, we're still contributing to the problem. And it's very hard to measure, well, this percent comes from Illinois, but this percent comes from Wisconsin. So that's why I say yes or no. We all contribute to it. And the bottom line is, if somebody's breathing it, their lungs don't care where it's coming from. Their lungs only know that they're breathing ozone and that it's not healthy.
So Wisconsin does have a varied report card. There's all these way of dissecting the cleanest, the dirtiest. So what stands out for you in Wisconsin?
First of all, the particle pollution grades are very, very good universally across Wisconsin. Even those communities on the lake, the particle pollution levels are within very acceptable levels. There are really some outstanding areas too as well. The ozone grades are outstanding in the central, the northern, and the western parts of the state. In fact, a couple of cities, metro areas, were on the cleanest list, the La Crosse, Onalaska area, and the Superior area on the cleanest.
Ashland, I think, right?
Ashland County was another one. So we're very, very glad to see those kinds of results. It's just that issue with the ozone along the lakefront. And the only way we're ever going to be able to address that is to continue to keep the Federal Clean Air Act strong. That's got a component in it. It's called the Good Neighbor Component. And what that does is it regulates trans-state or interstate pollution and makes those states that are downwind of Wisconsin do a little bit more and clean up a little bit more so that we're not paying the penalty. People tend to only look at the grades and they say it's an F, but you really have to dive deeper into the report and look at some of the charts that are on the website, and you see how that graph has gone down and down and down and down very precipitously. But we need to see it go away. We need to see it zero out or almost zero out.
And that's possible?
I think it is. I do think it is. People 19 years ago would not have thought it was possible to make the progress that we've made so far. I think it is possible. If we do what we can to address the few remaining sources of the VOCs and the nitrogen oxides, to do what we can to combat climate change and potentially impact the heat of our summers. I don't know to what degree that is possible. Probably some scientists would laugh and say, no, we can't do that, but do what we can do.
So when you look at the national level, are there initiatives afoot that have the Lung Association particularly busy, meaning talking with people, advocating to make sure something doesn't or does happen?
I would say presently the things that we are working on is rules and regulations that had been passed in the former administration that the present administration is now trying to roll back or repeal or even just delay, make them go out 2, 3, 5 years until they have to be implemented. They have been actively working at completely dismantling the Clean Power Plan, which is directed at climate change. So we're very vigorously defending that. Every time there is a budget, we did pass the fiscal 18 budget, but the fiscal 19 budget now, there are always riders that will weaken the Federal Clean Air Act, so we're always fighting those riders. Unfortunately, we're working in a defensive mode right now, we can't seem to move any policy forward, so what we're trying to do is just protect the policies that have been passed up to this time.
So is it fair to say the Clean Air Act is in jeopardy?
Well, the Clean Air Act is under fire, let's say that. A couple of things that we're presently working to defend is the new fuel standards for cars in the next 5 years and the miles per gallon that they will be required to get. That's something that is presently an attempt to roll that back. California's clean air standards. For decades, that California has had a waiver to have stronger laws than what's federal. And then states have the choice as to whether they want to follow federal law or whether they want to adopt the California standards. And there's probably a dozen or so states that actually follow the California standards. We're defending that right now because that's something else that the administration is trying to remove. It's trying to repeal it and just say one size fits all, everybody has to follow the same federal standards. The report itself does list about 6 different areas, and you could see where those rollbacks and those delaying tactics are taking place.
So we'll direct our listeners to that spot.
Yeah, it's really a fascinating read, a little deep in spots, but you don't have to read the whole thing from cover to cover, but it gives you the bigger picture than just looking at the grades.
Donna Wininski is the Tobacco Control and Public Policy Director with American Lung Association in Wisconsin. She spoke with Lake Effect's Susan Bentz about its 2018 American Lung Association State of the Air Report. You'll find a link to it at WUWM.com.
A new documentary tells the story of the life and work of a Wisconsin woman tragically murdered 5 years ago as she fought to end violence against women. We'll hear about the film when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. In the summer of 2013, 19-year-old Jesse Blodgett was a music education student at UW-Milwaukee, intent on changing the world through music. She was devoted to the cause of ending male violence against women.
But in July of 2013, Jessie Blodgett was raped and murdered in her own home. The story shook her hometown of Hartford, devastating many, especially her father, Buck.
5 years later, Buck Blodgett is continuing Jessie's work through the Love is Greater Than Hate project, a recent book, and now with a film directed by one of Jessie's high school friends, Terry Beck. Beck is a film student studying in Florida. His short documentary, Us Thereafter, started as a student project. It's a brief look into Jessie Blodgett's life, her legacy, and how she affected those who knew her.
Terry Beck and Buck Blodgett joined Audrey Nowakowski in the studio recently after a screening of the film in Chicago. Beck explains how he first met Jessie.
Jessie and I knew each other throughout high school. I can't really remember the exact moment that we met, but I think it was somewhere around freshman year of high school. We were involved in a lot of the same activities, like competitive public speaking and theater and things like that. And she was one of those people that I would just see around and I'd be like, I know that person, you know, I feel like I've seen her around, and then pretty soon we got introduced. We did a few plays together. You know, we were never hanging out all the time or anything like that, but we were close enough to where we had these really deep conversations whenever we were together, and we appreciated each other a lot for how little we did spend time together. I was actually in a musical with her at the time, Fiddler on the Roof, at the Shower Arts Center in Hartford, when she was killed. I saw her the night before and everything, so I was kind of thrown into the fire and everything when all of that went down and everything got turned on its head.
So what prompted you to make this documentary, Us Thereafter, years later?
I think what originally prompted it was when I was a freshman in college, the Dateline special that had been done came on TV, and me and my roommate were watching it. And don't get me wrong, I don't want to make it seem like I don't appreciate like what Dateline did. However, I do think that their approach to the situation did show that you could see that the filmmakers were not connected to the story. They were coming in, doing a job, telling a story that was not theirs. And it was like watching something that I already knew but through an entirely different lens. And it was just weird to me. And so I thought, what if I tried to do the same thing coming from the perspective of someone who lived through it? And knowing that I know all of Jessie's friends, or most of Jessie's friends, and so, you know, the possibility of interviewing them, and, you know, that's kind of where the title came from. Like, how did this affect us, and where did we all come from after this life-changing event? It was a story that I was often kind of uncomfortable to tell, but I thought if I was going to share it with everyone, what would be the best way to do it? And this just seemed like a really, really awesome way to kind of share who Jessie was and then also share the work that Buck was doing, so I ended up hitting him up like a year before I even shot the movie, and he was thrilled to do it. So, yeah.
Well, on that note, Buck, with Terry mentioned the Dateline special, which is a very different approach to telling stories and, you know, not necessarily sensationalizing something, but making it appealing to a broader audience, you know, to make people feel connected to something that happened in Hartford, Wisconsin, across the U.S. And I know you had some trepidation for them to produce that piece, as well as other news pieces that were happening directly after Jessie's death. But what were your feelings with Terry when he called you up and said, hey, I want to do a film project, when you had gone through these other experiences with various productions before?
Yeah, we said no to Dateline for 15 months until the trial was over, and then said yes when one of my coworkers said, you should tell her story to millions of people and let them know about her project. And then I looked at it differently and thought, yeah, you're right. But when Terry contacted me, first of all, like everything, it was just another opportunity for Jessie's voice to be heard. Jessie lost a lot of things when she was murdered, and so did everybody else who knew her. And that might have been the biggest one, was just her voice. And to have a friend bring it back, I just jumped at the chance.
The film starts with testimonials from Jessie's friends and the importance of music in her life and your life, too. So why did you want to start it this way?
There was a really interesting question that I received when we were actually at the film festival, was how did I remain objective? And I really stumbled over that question a lot, because oftentimes when you're a documentarian, not trying to claim I am one, but like what I learned from that is like you oftentimes want to remain objective because you are trying to tell someone else's story. But when trying to answer that question, I realized that there was no reason that I needed to stay objective. Buck was telling the truth. It was telling his truth, and it was, you know, telling his story. There was nothing that was going to kind of be misconstrued by that. And so I wanted the opportunity to show what I love about Jesse and what I love about the story. And so it was kind of like, in the interest of objectivity versus subjectivity, I was like, all right, the first half is going to be all about Jesse and what we loved about her and what you would have loved about her if you had known her. And so it's just all about Jesse and talking about who she was, you know, hearing her voice singing and then talking with her friends and their favorite memories, which, you know, like just it just conjures up an image and you kind of almost get a chance to feel like you did know her for a quick moment. And then transitioning into the more like nitty gritty, the harsh reality of it, and then getting into the objective, here's what happened and here's what happened after. I don't know. It was kind of an opportunity for me to kind of have the closure and the part that I felt like I really needed from this film, which was just sharing Jesse with the world. And then also having the equally important opportunity to share what Buck's doing.
How difficult was that for you to do that within 8 minutes?
It was pretty difficult because I'm a long-winded person, as you can probably already tell. I went on with some interviews for hours. There wasn't anybody we cut, but there was a lot of material we cut. And I don't know, in terms of an emotional level, it was often kind of difficult to, you know, keep from choking up and everything like that. But more often than that, I think it was just pure joy. People were telling me that they forgot how happy it made them to like reminisce on that kind of stuff. So I was not quite as emotional as I thought I was going to be. But when it got down to the cutting room floor, it was a matter of kind of getting what's important within the realms of like the project's limits, which, you know, you kind of have to weigh out the good and the bad with that. But yeah, no, I think we struck like a really nice balance. If people are truly like inspired by it, they can learn more, which is all I can ask for.
Right. And Buck, that's kind of the balance you seek every day of sharing the best of Jesse and then also sharing the project.
That's exactly right. And it amazed me how good of a job Terry did in 7 minutes and some seconds. To give you a sample, after people saw the documentary, complete strangers from other states and other nations even came up to me and Joy after, and they were hugging us and crying for us and with us. And I could see in them that they felt like they knew Jesse now, and they'd lost Jesse too from a 7-minute documentary. I don't know how you do that, but Terry did.
Mm-hmm. Well, in having a mix of archival footage, interviews, condensing the nitty-gritty, as you call it, to the text that you have, you know, was it difficult of an edit production, you know, on, I know how long it can take to edit something down too. But with balancing those three different components to be effective.
Yeah. I think I got the dialogue quickly, but it was the imagery that we, like, when we were in cut screenings working with my colleagues and my professors, like trying to figure out what should be shown while we're hearing it. And so if you see it, we start on kind of some drone footage of the town of Hartford, kind of getting like a bird's eye view. And then from that point on, a big question was, how do we transition? Do we want to see Jesse? Do we want to see her playing the piano? How do we want to introduce her? The first shot of Jesse you see is with her back to the camera. So how do we get them to feel connected with her instantly? And so we added a picture of her looking directly into the camera. That was, I think, the most fun process, was finding the stuff that, like, what images are the viewer going to connect with? Because it's sometimes something you can overlook, which was really, really fun.
Well, and Buck, what is it like for you to relearn all of these different perspectives of Jesse and how people see her?
You know, people always say to me after a presentation or this documentary or reading the book, you know, or the trial especially, I'm so sorry you have to relive this. Well, Joy and I relive this every second for almost 5 years now. We're constantly thinking about Jesse. We can't help it. You know, you learn to function in life and adapt to it, but she's always there. So I don't think I really did relearn anything or revisit anything, because I feel like I've never left visiting with Jesse. But it's, you know, it's a heck of a way to be famous. But I really love that people come up afterwards, and even if they are complete strangers from different states and different countries, and talk about her. And I can see in their eyes the connection, in their heart I can feel the connection they now have with her. and the support they have for her mission and her purpose in coming here. It means everything to me.
Lots of great feedback from audiences. And as this continues to show in various platforms, ultimately, how does it make the two of you feel with this finished project? I mean, I know it was a school assignment, and I know looking back at things, you probably wish, like, oh, I could have done this differently. So what do you think every time you see it again?
Well, it was interesting. I was talking to Buck about that after it screened, which was that I hadn't watched the film in probably maybe a year when we saw it up on the big screen at this festival. And so watching it, I don't know. I'm still just like so pleased with it. I don't want to bore people with like the technicalities. Like there are some shots that are slightly out of focus that I wish I could go back and get back in focus, or like, you know, maybe some cuts that I could have, you know, thought out better. But I was a fresh youngin' in the film school, not really knowing what I was doing. But I think it's run its course really well throughout the festival circuit, which, you know, only can reach so many people. And I think that I'm really pleased with the response that it's gotten and the limited but very valuable, in my opinion, opportunities that I've had to speak about it. This is one of the most important movies that I've made in my short career in school, and so I feel blessed that I was able to like talk about it. But I'm totally excited now to kind of share it with more people through Buck's project and everything like that, and just have it be a tool for him now because it's done its job for me.
Yeah, completely unbiased opinion here, of course, but this is the best movie Terry's ever made and ever will make. But, Terry's a filmmaker, so his mind goes towards every aspect of the film. But mine, I don't think about the technicalities. I think about the heart of it. And if you want to see a powerful story in 7 minutes and be touched deeply and maybe be changed a little on the inside, then this is a great way to spend 7 minutes.
Well, Terry and Buck, thank you both for coming in today and talking about Us Thereafter.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Audrey.
Buck Blodgett is an author and the founder of the Love is Greater Than Hate Project. Filmmaker Terry Beck made Us Thereafter, a short documentary about the story of Jesse Blodgett. They spoke with Audrey Nowakowski after a recent screening of the film at the Peace on Earth Film Festival in Chicago. You can watch the film and find out more about Jesse's story at WUWM.com.
Another break now, and then we'll take a trip over to the Harley-Davidson Museum to visit the redesigned engine room and hear some of the engines from more than 100 years of motorcycle history. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Imagine going to the Baseball Hall of Fame and knowing nothing about baseball, or the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame having only listened to opera your whole life. That kind of disconnect is a key challenge for the curators of the Harley-Davidson Museum when it comes to presenting motorcycle engines.
One of the centerpieces of the museum's permanent collection is its engine room, a display that shows off engines from the iconic motorcycle, both how they look and how they sound. But they have to do it in a way that reaches people, regardless of their tech savvy.
The engine room just underwent a significant redesign, so it seemed like the right time to stop by the now 10-year-old museum, where we met a couple of the key people behind the engine room, starting with curatorial and exhibits lead Kristen Jones.
You know, the engine room is a really important part of our visit. It actually is in the beginning of the museum, so it really functions as an introduction to a lot of the things that people are going to see throughout the rest of the exhibits. We undertook some visitor research last year, and we were able to kind of do a deep dive into what our visitors thought of our exhibits and what they were learning in our exhibits. And one of the things that we found out was that they weren't exactly using the engine wall and the accompanying interactive in the way that we had hoped they would. So we wanted to address that, and we wanted to update some things, but also make this a little bit more user-friendly. We get all kinds of people who come here with all different levels of knowledge. We have people who come here who are completely green, don't really know anything about engines, know that, you know, with their cars, for instance, you turn the key and it goes, to people who have lots of expertise, people who are engineers, people who are long-term mechanics. So we wanted to do something that could really focus on all of those different levels of knowledge.
Well, and so from a curatorial standpoint, what was the challenge in being able to do that in this space?
One of the challenges that we faced was really trying to make sure that we were holding everyone's attention. We wanted to make sure we were giving some of the basics, but also not making people who had a certain level of expertise feel like, oh, well, this really isn't for me. I know all of this already. We want to make sure that we engage people. We want to give them something new, maybe something that they never expected or didn't know before.
All right, so what is that? What's the new and unexpected when it comes to showcasing engines?
Well, the engines are really the heart of a Harley-Davidson, and each one is purpose-built. It's purpose-designed. So some of the engines were really, you know, made for racing, for instance, or they were made to cool in the desert for use during World War II. But our big twin family, that's really the core of our engine and our engine history. And we wanted to be able to give people some information as to the very basics of how an engine works, but also give them some trivia and also give some other assets out here on the floor.
I'm kind of amazed as I look at this because you have them arranged on the wall in timeline fashion. And obviously the newer ones are more sophisticated, but the look really hasn't changed all that much in 100 plus years.
Correct. And that V-twin shape, that 45-degree V-twin engine is really the hallmark of our engine history. And that's what we wanted to portray by putting those engines in the center. So we relocated all of the big twins to the center of the wall so that they're prominent. We added some interpretation as well. But we do have some unusual-looking engines that really deviate from that as well.
Before we get into the actual mechanics of a Harley engine, what else is in this room?
So this room is our engine gallery. We have many things dedicated to the look of the engine, the sound of the engine, and also the feel of the engine. And those are kind of the hallmark traits of Harley-Davidson, look, sound, and feel. So in the center of the gallery, we have a bike that is a knucklehead, which actually is one of the nicknames of one of our famous V-twins, where the pieces have been sliced apart, but from a certain vantage point, it resolves into a full motorcycle.
And as someone who does this kind of thing for a living, that is kind of, I mean, the viewscape that you have in this room. I mean, it is a big room, and you have kind of this unique ability to arrange it in such a way that it can be broken down into its component parts, but you can stand in such a way that it resolves into a single bike.
Yes, it's the exploded vehicle. It does resolve from a certain vantage point. And again, because this is one of the first galleries that people encounter during their visit, we wanted to give kind of a nice little extra surprise for people.
All right, so I appreciate the look of the engine. I appreciate the sound of the engine. Never having ridden a Harley myself, tell me how you simulate the feel of an engine.
We have an interactive here in the engine gallery where we actually have people be able to get a little bit more of a sense of the feel of a motorcycle. Now, of course, we're on radio, so you don't see me, but I'm a smaller individual. But I am able to balance a motorcycle because of the gyroscopic effect that's created by the very heavy flywheels that are in the engine. So the bike, when it's running at that speed, really wants to stay upright. So that allows people of all different sizes to be able to get on a big bike and ride it.
All right. Well, I feel like at this point we really need to get more into the inner workings of the Harley engine. And before we do that, why don't I have you introduce yourself? Who are you and what do you do here?
My name's Bill Redensel, and I am the lead for museum collections here.
All right, so take me through what visitors learn when they walk into this engine room. I'm sure they are drawn to this wall because A, it is illuminated, and B, it looks amazing.
Exactly, and that's part of the visual is to draw them in, to attract them here. And once we have them, what a lot of people, you know, they know an engine, they know it powers whatever vehicle it is, they just don't know actually how it works. So we tried to really simplify in the most basic terms, you know, how does an engine actually work? And people talk about, you know, our look, sound, feel. The way our engine and the geometry of our engine affects all of that. So we really explain through there. So we can actually, when guests come here, there are four kiosks that are all identical, have the same information, but they can step up to there, and there's three actual steps to the interactive. Engine basics, classic Harley engine, where you actually learn about our big twin, which is our classic Harley engine, and then get to explore all the engines that are exist on the engine wall. You get to actually look at both sides of them, see vehicles that they would be in, and then actually get to hear each and every engine that's on the wall.
And we should note that the engines on the wall are not the one, that they don't actually start up.
They don't actually start up. What we did is we had about, in our previous iteration of the wall, we had about half of the sounds. So we went about kind of traveling the United States to find, because some of these engines, they may be, they're one or two existing examples that actually run. And so we kind of did some field recordings to capture those unique sounds. And people get to hear a 1909 Harley single, or get to hear a Pose twin engine, which is a very different sounding engine than our typical twin.
So before we get to those sounds, because I think we really ought to hear some of those sounds, walk us through what we would learn here. What are the basics of a motorcycle engine?
So part of this wall, there's a little tactile display on the far right side and on the far left side, where, you know, people know a cylinder. Okay, well, what makes up a cylinder? What are the parts of that? So we actually have some pieces that they can touch and see to kind of get their feet wet a little bit before they get into the kiosk. Once they get into the kiosk, we start real simple. What's a one cylinder and what's a two cylinder, or our twin engine? When they started out, they called them singles and double cylinders, and now it's evolved into the twin. So you actually get to kind of look inside. So there's some animation. You get to see, how does that piston go up, and what is a piston first, and how does it go up and down in the cylinder? How is it connected to the flywheel? And be able to compare and contrast between twins and single engines. And then you can actually touch the twins, and it'll highlight in a graphic which engines on the wall you're looking at are the twins or are the singles. We talk about the actual engine geometry, 45 degrees, where the cylinders are separated, 45 degrees, 60 degrees, or 180 degrees. This is a real big key in the sound of our engine. Engines have a cadence. And a single, having only one cylinder, is kind of a steady beat. In a 180-degree opposed twin, they fire actually opposite of each other. So it's boom, 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 boom. In our 45-degree twin, it's actually a cadence where they fire quickly after one another, so it's ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-boom. Also in here, you get to look at how it works. When we do how it works, we put a simple drum beat to it. This is our 180 degree, and you can see it's pretty constant. When you go to our 45 degree twin, different pattern to that. And then, of course, single, when you go to the single, it's steady drum beat.
Steady, and in this case, very slow drum beat.
Yeah, and you notice it's only hitting half the time as a twin cylinder. There's, you know, when we talk about the four actual patterns of an engine, the flywheel, the big flywheel in the engine, will actually rotate two complete times in order to complete those four cycles of a four-cycle engine.
And so, you went out on these field recordings?
I did, actually. Believe it or not, in a past life, my degree from college was in sound engineering, and so I used to do a lot of that. And so I worked with a local engineer, and we traveled as far away as North Carolina to actually capture some of these engines. Some of them we found right around here in Milwaukee. One of them, the rarest, being our 8-valve, which is our... it's a race engine. They only made about 25 total. So finding one and then finding one that runs is really extremely rare.
That must have been a kick.
It was great. And we actually made a couple little films of it. And, you know, people will be able to actually, you know, go on our social media and see one of these run. They're really unique because there's no exhaust pipes on them. So the ports into the cylinder are open, and flames actually shoot out when it runs. So it's pretty neat.
We should hear this.
We should hear that one. other race engines, our XR750 that we had for years and years. And both of these are twin cylinders, but what's unique about them is, even though they're all 45 degrees, there is some bit of similarity between all of those.
Is there one that we would maybe never recognize as a Harley-Davidson if it weren't for the fact that you were telling us?
Absolutely. So if you go to our singles, there's several in here, but one of them is, believe it or not, we made from 1961 until 1978, we were partnered with a company in Italy, and they made some Italian-made singles. So we'll take a listen to one of these. Harley-Davidson also made a single-cylinder engine that was a two-stroke engine. So when you think of two-stroke, think of your lawnmower or something similar to that. And it was 165cc engine, and we made that from the 40s into the mid-60s. And you can take a listen to one of those.
Maybe the slightest bit louder than a lawnmower.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But very different. Not what people think of as that quintessential Harley-Davidson potato, potato, potato.
Let me ask this question to both of you, actually. Sure. So this came together over how long did it take to bring this this revamped engine room together?
We were working on it for about 7 months.
So there has to be, if not a sense of ownership, certainly a real connection to what you've been able to do. As you look around, I mean, how do you, you know, sort of reconcile what was in your mind with what you see around us today?
I think what we've done really, you know, sometimes we were both involved in the original iteration, and sometimes it's hard to let go of that. But I think what we've done here really improves the experience for our visitors. You know, we are coming up on our 10th year of being open. And we're really evaluating how people have been using things here over the past 10 years and always looking to improve and always looking to give our visitors the best experience possible.
Well, right. I imagine that, you know, at one level you have to realize that that what you do doesn't exist in a vacuum. Like, what you think visitors might get out of an exhibit and what they actually do get out of an exhibit can often be two different things.
Yes, I think that that's true. I think, you know, sometimes what people, what we envision people getting out of an exhibit is actually different from what we observe. And one of the things that's difficult, we have such an amazing, vast collection of materials here. And of course, it's hard for us to sometimes decide what to edit. And that was one of the challenges with this engine wall, is that we actually took some engines away because they didn't really help to tell the story that we were looking to tell.
I have to say, the thing that was really came through to me is we're such a small group that did this. And the first time we did it, it was, we didn't know. We had never, you know, even built a museum of this magnitude. So we were like, well, this would be neat. And even that changed as we did it. And you came out with the final product and it was great. Then you find out, you know, we could have done it better. And so we're really lucky to get that second shot to say, let's do it. Let's do some of the things we wanted to do in the first time. Like Kristen said, take away some of the things that, you know, we put up there just because they were neat. But did they confuse people? Did it not really, you know, tell that story that you wanted to communicate? Plus, in 10 years, the company has changed a lot, and we've come out with a lot of different new products, and we want to represent those on the wall as well.
Has to be a little like being a musician who, you know, puts out an album and figures, well, this one's going to be the hit, and it turns out everybody likes this one.
A little bit of that, or the musician that says, oh, if I could go in and re-record that. And so we were given the ability to actually, like, you know, do a do-over and say, let's do it. And so we didn't really radically change it, because it's quite behind the actual wall, the structure that holds it up. There's no moving it. It's pretty permanent, but we were able to, you know, shift it around and really, I think, just tell that the story clearer.
Got to be a pretty strong wall. Those must be pretty heavy engines.
There's quite a superstructure actually behind the drywall there. But we've actually modified the way that we're attaching the engines so that in the future, as we want to make additional changes, we can do so more easily.
Well, thanks to both of you, and congratulations on the redesign.
My pleasure. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Kristen Jones is the curatorial and exhibits lead, and Bill Redensel is the collections lead at the Harley Davidson Museum. You can see a slideshow from the museum's redesigned engine room at WUWM.com.
One last break, and then we'll give a listen to a recent recording from the Lake Effect Performance Studio. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Just one round on my motorcycle. Lake Effect continues on WUWM Now. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. Despite their name, Birds of Chicago is neither a group of birds, nor do they reside in Chicago. They actually call Nashville home, but the group, led by Allison Russell and J.T. Narrow, actually spends a fair amount of time in Milwaukee, where Narrow's family lives.
Their new album, Love in Wartime, is out tomorrow. We had the good fortune to get a preview when Russell and Narrow stopped by the studio last month. Here are Allie Russell and J.T. Narrow with Super Lover.
Tears of rage, tears of grief from Inglewood to Nairobi. We need a super love, need a super lover. Double Dutch and hula hoops, all our fears and loops. We need a super love, need a super lover. All the night so cold. Who among us dreams the dawn? Who could count the flowers in your heart? Lord, let me die before my child prayed. Every mother far and wide, that's a super love. I'm a super lover. You can feel it near and far. It fades the moon and blinds the stars. That's a super love. Are you a super lover? Oh, the night so cold. Who among us dreams the dawn? Who could count the flowers in your heart? Need a super lover.
Allison Russell and JT Nero are Birds of Chicago. That song was called Super Lover, and it's from the group's new album Love in Wartime, which comes out tomorrow. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. So great to have you listening today, as it always is, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock, and Fresh Air is next.